I'm honored to present Kath Thompson as our guest for the one-year anniversary of the Hadean podcast. Kath is the author of 7 books on the topic of the English Kabbalah, or EQ, being a foundational member of the British magical group which pioneered this innovative system of magic in the 1970s. In this episode, we discuss the part Kath played in developing new forms of astrological magic via the exploration of Aleister Crowley's Liber Alvel Legis, the Book of the Law. We discuss the Gematria, which was discovered from this exploration, and the rituals which were undertaken to test their findings, the use of the tarot, how we can create our own war engine, and how to ground ourselves properly, keeping our heads cool after deeply moving spiritual experiences. Kath's latest text, The Mystery of the Letters, is the final book in her series outlining and describing the nature of the EQ and how the modern sorcerer may begin this work of revealed astrological magic. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and I am very happy to welcome Kath Thompson to the Hadean Press podcast. Hi, Kath. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you for inviting me.
I think many people will be already very familiar with you in regards to Hadean Press, as you have been a longtime author and contributor. But for those less familiar with your work, could you briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. I was born in East London, and my forebears are Scottish and Huguenot French and Cornish and Kentish. Cockneys. I have cabinet makers and carpenters and mathematicians and musicians and one or two Freemasons in my immediate ancestry. My family moved in, I think, 1975 to Tamworth, which is a town in the English Midlands, which is where Jim Lees had his magical group. And I met group members in about 1980, and I was initiated into the group and became a fully functioning English Kabbalist and learning astrology and Hebrew Kabbalah at the same time. And I undertook to type Jim's notes and gradually built this archive of typed material saved on home computers as they were then. And then eventually when Jim died, I became his legal executor, and seemed like a good idea to get his work published, you know, into a form that would last rather than just being on sheets of paper or on computer disks that may not survive very long into the future. Get it into books and they'll last 100 years at least. So that was my plan. So I became a writer, and I've just finished that project.
Yes, so today we will be discussing the English Kabbalah, or the EQ, its theory and practice, with a focus on your own contributions to the system and your now 7 books published through Hadean Press. Your first book, The Magical Language of the Book of the Law, goes into this subject in depth. But for those of our audience who haven't read your work, could you describe the unique features of this system of magic?
Yes. One of the things about it is that it wasn't made up. It's not a product of any invention by Jim or by members of his group. It's a mathematical pattern that exists in the 26 letters. If you count every 11th letter, you get the order and value of the English alphabet, A, L, W, H, and so forth. If you write the ordinary alphabet, A, B, C, D, round the circle and then join every 11th letter, you'll find you've drawn a unicursal 26-pointed star, which is quite neat, which is one of the one of the tests that was done quite early on and seems to prove it as a valid system. And it allows you to analyze English words objectively without any of the historical or political or cult baggage that they come with. You can just take the word and go at it according to its numerical value. And it proves that Liber Al, Vel Legis, is a holy book. Because one of the qualifications for a holy book is it should have its own gematria, which you can use to further your understanding of the holy book and also the rest of the world in which you live. So those are some of the unique features.
So you mentioned Jim Lees. Could you explain something more about who he was and how did he come to discover this, or the group that he was involved in? How did they come to find this this system that was built into the language of the Book of the Law?
Yes. Jim was an astrologer and a Hebrew Kabbalist to begin with. And he worked his way through, as a younger man, he worked his way through the magical systems and procedures that were available in the 50s and 60s. Key of Solomon and the Abramelin system and Franz Barden's works. And of course, the stuff published by the Golden Dawn and Aleister Crowley. And he reached a point where he thought he was capable of running a group and it would be interesting to share what he had learned with other people. So he did this and they formed a, I think there were four or five of them to start with. And in 1976, Jim decided to have a magical retirement, which is where you just don't do any magical work at all. And eventually he decided to have a look at the Book of the Law and see if he could work out any answers to the problems that it was still posing in 1976. And messing about with calculators and pen and paper and trying all sorts of different ideas like A equals one, B equals two, C equals three. Yeah. And having and looking at a particular verse in the Book of the Law, verse 76 in the second chapter, which is just a string of letters and numbers. Everybody came up with the same number, 286, even though they were doing different sums with should have produced different results, but all the calculators came up with this number 286. And Jim realized that it's the 22 times 13 is 286, and 26 times 11 is 286. So if 22 times 13 represents the Hebrew alphabet of 22 letters, then maybe the 26 times 11 represents the English alphabet. So let's see what happens if we count every 11th letter. And sure enough, they get this ALWH SDOZ sequence. And then it was a matter of adding words up and finding words that came to the same value and making enumerated books of the law with all the numbers calculated and put in under the words and just generally trying to figure out what it meant and where it would lead. And this was what the group were doing in the late 70s. And in 1980, or maybe 1979, 1980, Jim published a magazine called The New Equinox, the British Journal of Magic. And he published some of the early results of the English Kabbalistic investigations. And that was how we met Jake. Jake was offered this magazine title and its existing readership, where he didn't want to do it at the time. But he wrote an article that was published in one of the editions of TNEBJM. And later, Jim gave the whole magazine format over to Jake, and Jake took it up and gave it a different title. He said, it's not new anymore, so we'll call it the Equinox. It's, you know, no longer the new Equinox, because none of this is really new anymore. And he did 11 editions altogether before he stopped.
And so now those 11 editions of the Equinox are available as Magnus Dictus?
Yes, yes.
How would you define a Kabbalah then?
Oh, Kabbalah is a Hebrew word, and it just means received wisdom. So it just means received wisdom. That's the usual translation of it. And it's usually spelt with a K. There are no fixed rules about converting Hebrew into English. There aren't really equivalent letters, because you're going from 22 to 26. So Kabbalah is usually spelt with a K and a double B, and sometimes an H on the end as well. But in 1976, the spelling that we used, Q-A-B-A-L-L-A, was not one of the varieties that was in use by anybody. So Jim picked that as for the name of this new system. So it's an English received wisdom.
So how would you describe the benefit of having a Gematria and a Kabbalah in English?
If you're an English speaker, and if you think and dream in English, then having your own Gematria in your own language is going to be more useful to you than if you have to convert everything into Greek or into Hebrew and then convert it back again and try and arrive at some clear understanding, having gone through that process. And you might be accused of cultural misappropriation if you mess about with the Hebrew Kabbalah, because of course it is the Hebrew system. It is meant for the Hebrew holy books, and it's questionable whether it's really acceptable for non-Hebrew people to delve into it. Although, having said that, the Golden Dawn system, the Golden Dawn Tree of Life, the Tarot, all that works. Don't throw it out just because it's in Hebrew. It's not your language. It all works. But now we've got English Kabbalah, why not? Why not do it in your own language? This is the new aeon.
So that brings me to my next question, really, which is, what is the importance of Liber Alvel Legis?
It is what Crowley said it was. It is a holy book. And it's the first holy book since the Quran, since the Prophet Muhammad, peace be unto him, received the verses of the Quran. It's new, it's modern, it's for this time and the future.
And do you think that there was, say, like, we all know the story of how Iwas supposedly arrived and relayed the message, and, you know, we could say that there was a guiding hand at work, not only with that text, but perhaps even with the English language itself. Could you elaborate any further on that point?
Oh yes, I'm reasonably certain of this guiding hand idea, because the numeric correspondences of the English Kabbalah do work, and the English language is made up of Old English words, Latin words, Greek words, Persian words, words from the Asian subcontinent. It's one or two Chinese words in English. It's a whole basket of other languages, all reinterpreted and spelled in English and reused in the English language. So So for all those languages to produce English words, and then for those English words to have numeric values that correspond, it's something that could only have been organized. It couldn't have happened by accident. The evolution of the English language is a very precise development, in right up to the adding of the letter J.
So what do you think about IWAS, the entity itself? Do you think that IWAS was the guiding hand, or do you think it was perhaps a herald of that spirit, or
I don't know. I don't know. The whole story of the reception of the Book of the Law is shrouded in mystery. Nobody really knows. Crowley didn't really leave any sufficient account. We know that Rose identified the stele, which became known as the Stele of Revealing in the Burlap Museum. We know that she was suddenly able to identify Egyptian deities and talk about occult matters, which she had no training in and on to all intents and purposes no knowledge of, which was quite surprising to Crowley himself. She was able to answer his questions, and he didn't think she would be able to. And then she gave him these instructions to go and sit in the room at midday with a pen and a pad of paper or a notebook and take the dictation and not to look round. Somebody recently suggested that whoever it was doing the dictating actually took Rose's body and spoke through her. So it would have been Rose standing behind Aleister Crowley saying, had the manifestation of Nuit. And don't turn round, darling, because you won't believe what you're seeing.
do you think that perhaps Crowley removed that from his record?
I don't see why he should. I don't see why he should consider it necessary to falsify anything. He was a magician, and I think his magical integrity is unimpeachable. So I don't think he would have falsified anything about that encounter.
I meant specifically that Rose communicated instead of, well, maybe that Iwas spoke through Rose. So he never clearly says where the voice comes from. He sort of shoos Rose away, apparently, in one of his diary entries.
Yes, I suspect that's just Crowley being a late Victorian gentleman and the little woman, this is not suitable, she won't know anything about this, and she should be in the kitchen.
Although I think it's very interesting when we calculate the value of Rose Kelly's name in EQ, because it has a very specific equivalence, doesn't it, Kath?
Yeah, it has the same value with Thelema, doesn't it? Or Thelema or Thelema. Yes. But you can only do that with EQ. And at the time, EQ wasn't there, so that little revelation wasn't available to Aleister Crowley.
It's a very interesting revelation, though. I'm quite convinced by that.
Yeah, it's neat, isn't it? It just didn't, the timelines didn't match. Sucks.
Okay, so what's your opinion on the comment of the Book of the Law in relation to EQ? Because there's a specific part of the comment which it essentially says, don't explore any further and don't examine the contents of the book. And EQ is really founded on the very principle of diving into and exploring into the book. So how do you square the idea of EQ with Crowley's dire portents of and dire warnings and things of what will happen to you if you do so?
Well, it's a sort of, you don't know what you might find here. You don't know what you might come across if you start delving into the Book of the Law with English Kabbalah. And it might be worrying to you. So be careful. Buyer beware, as it were. I think it's sound advice, the comment generally. It's pretty sound advice. Some people do actually destroy their first copy and then they go out and buy another one. But that initial destruction is an important little ritual to follow through.
I think Jake became quite infamous at one point after he did a presentation where he did a reading from the Book of the Law and then tore the pages out and threw them into a fire.
Yeah. I hadn't heard of that, but yeah, that would be appropriate.
So we touched earlier on the idea that Jim Lees was an astrologer, and we know already from your books that astrology plays a fairly large, or maybe incredibly vital component of the system of EQ. So, could you sort of explain a little about why you think astrology is so important to the Western magical practice and to EQ specifically?
Yes, well, astrology is one of the oldest forms of magic. It's one of the oldest correspondence systems that we have, and it has evolved over the centuries. And it's about the moment in time and the influences in the universe or the cosmos that are at play in that moment of time. So if you organize your rituals to take advantage of conducive astrology, good astrology as we would say, you're more likely of success than if you don't check what the astrology is and you find that you've done a ritual under really appalling stars. If you invoke Mercury, make sure Mercury isn't retrograde. Make sure he isn't conjunct Saturn, because those things will blur the signal that you're getting from Mercury, and they will interfere with you, the result of your invocation. That's our theory. Every moment is a birth of what happens next. So, and astrological configurations will influence the moment, much as an astrologer can read from a natal chart a representation of the moment of birth, but the personality and characteristics and future development of the baby. So what kind of a person it will be, well, what kind of a job it will have, what kind of a house it will have, what its interests and likes and dislikes, and all these things. So it's For us, it's very important to catch the right moment. For the grimoire magicians, the sorcerers who rely more on planetary hours and don't seem to take too much notice of the astrological conditions themselves, it's not so important. Time, but it is all about the time. The timing. Timing is everything, as everybody knows.
So, did an examination of the Book of the Law using the gematria of the EQ reveal anything specific about astrology or the manner in which astrology can be used within the system?
Oh, definitely, definitely, yes. In the first chapter of the Book of the Law, at least, there are lots of mentions of stars, which is one of the encouragements to have a look at the zodiac and the planets and see what their values were. And we find all sorts of interesting numeric correspondences between zodiac signs and planetary names and other words. For instance, spring in tropical astrology is zero of Aries, spring equinox. Aries has the same value as seeds, which you plant in spring. And then when you get to the autumn equinox, that's harvest time, that's Libra. Libra has the same value as crop, which is what you get from your seeds. And Yeah, that's very neat. And then you get to other ones, like for instance, Jupiter has the same value as perfect, which sits very nicely into the tree of life notion of Jupiter and the sphere of Chesed, which is a perfection from 1 to 4. It's a summation and a sort of perfection of everything that's gone before. And all kinds of things. Scorpio is particularly interesting. Scorpio has the value 93, which I'm sure we'll come back to. The 93 has the same value as nature and mother and virgin. And mother nature is always virgin. She can never really be touched.
I'm particularly interested in the almost like koans, where you compare two opposite words with the same value as a not only as like as a meditative exercise, but all they can be utilized for magical purposes as well, because they're in the same way Austin Osman Spare was say playing with the neither.
Yes. Austin Osman Spare, if he had had EQ, what might he have done? He was very close with his sigils and putting letters together.
So, Kath, in your opinion, what is a language and what is the importance of the word in magic? And do you consider word symbols or like or phrases to be spirits in and of themselves, or perhaps you could say a word is possessed of spirit?
A word is possessed of spirit. The words are symbols, phonetic symbols primarily, so they're symbols of sounds. And sound is the importance of sound is only just being investigated scientifically. There are theories that sound was what was used to raise those huge blocks of stone to build the pyramids. And nobody knows quite how to do it, but they're beginning to think that they might be on the way to, when I say they, I mean the scientists experimenting with these things. Sound does all sorts of weird things. The sound will move iron filings into geometric shapes. And these geometric designs, you see them all over the place in tile patterns in churches and temples around the world. Words, language is a means of communication from one person to another, assuming they both understand the sounds to mean the same things. Or the written symbols. Because when you read words, the sound of them appears in your mind spontaneously. If you read a word, you'll hear it, as it were. And they can be really, really potent, really, really powerful. Well, you know that the Torahs are written out by hand by special qualified rabbis, and when they come to write the name of God, sometimes they'll go away and prepare for a day before they sit down to write the word of God. It is so powerful. And other Hebrew scholars will pay to be present when this rabbi writes the name of God because it is such a momentous thing to write. So words, and if you give your word, that's making a promise to do something or to be somewhere or to arrange something. It's like, I will do this or that, or I will be this or that. And it's about your self-identity. It's about your integrity. Do you keep your word? Is your word unimpeachable? Or are you unreliable? It's all about you and how you identify yourself and how other people see you. So, and magically, that's very, very important. You give your word. The word is a starting point. It's a beginning. You might say, like in the Gospels, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. It's everything that is going to happen is contained in that first moment, that first word. You start as you mean to go on. So magically, if you say, I will do this, I will get up at dawn and do this ritual, and I will do it every day. That's a very important statement for you to make. And you might find it actually very difficult if you just say, I will get up at dawn every day and do this ritual every day. And 6 months on, you've been doing this thing every day, getting up at dawn every day because you said you would. And you're really getting tired of it, and you really like a break. But you can't because you gave your word, and it becomes a bit of a nuisance. So if you're thinking of doing something like that, say, I will get up at dawn and do this ritual for 1 month, or for a fortnight, or for a couple of days, even. And give it a limit, and then you let yourself off the hook. Makes life a lot easier every time.
Yes. I understand that feeling of, oh my God, I wish I wasn't doing this right now.
Yes,
But you have to
yes.
push through and just keep pushing, keep pushing, keep pushing.
You will find, though, after a while, you're pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing, and you're creating so much pressure that the best thing to do is stop and then let it come back to you. You end up creating pressure against the thing that you're looking for. So you stop pushing and let it come back.
I've learned so much about not only myself but my practice and everything since I started doing it. So I highly recommend that some kind of daily practice, however you choose to express it. I think it's very
Yes,
important.
me too. I started out doing the pentagram, as so many people of my generation did. The pentagram ritual every day. And you eventually, you know the thing so well, you can do it in your head.
Coming to your current book, which is titled The Mysteries of the Letters, you say, quote, the matriarchal signature on the work of creation is plainly seen through the e-Kabbalistic lens, end quote. The EQ has a very particular emphasis on the goddess and specifically female mysteries. Could you describe something of this and perhaps something about how you perceive or you interpret this deity?
Creation in EQ has the same value as Empress. So that's a good place to start, as the Empress is the chief feminine symbol after the priestess in the Tarot. It's ruled by Venus. And Venus is the supreme goddess in the planetary pantheon. The archetypal or perfected woman is represented in the lunar cycle, 28 days fertility menstrual cycle. So the lunar cycle pertains directly to your human female, your mature human female. We always say Mother Earth, Mother Nature. And mother has the same value as nature, so there's another bit. The goddess, the creation, comes from in our system, comes from nothing. Nothing divides and produces something. And it's that nothing that is the ultimate goddess.
And is this what we would say is the zero equals two formula?
Yes, that's it. That's it. And we find if we add up void in the beginning, the void, and then the word is spoken into the void, but the void came first. So what's the value of void? Oh dear, it's the same as woman. Oh, that won't do. Let's add up abyss, because that's the same thing after a different fashion. So the value of abyss is same as woman. And she's just there everywhere you look. The goddess is there. Man has the same value as sun, the big bright thing that's going to be eclipsed in a few days' time. So that takes you somewhere else. Has the same value as air as well, the element of air. But water has the same value as goddess. Fire has the same value as Nuit, who is the supreme goddess in the Book of the Law. And Earth, I think, has the same value as Sophia. Earth is a more female, more feminine, more goddessy, Mother Earth. And man gets the air element.
So what we're seeing really is essentially the values of the words as we've discovered through Lieber Al produce through analysis or exegesis a new creation story, a new creation myth or equivalent. We see once more that the void, the waters are divided, in this case for the sake of love. And we see all this same imagery and all of these components which have existed in so many other religions and mysteries throughout history, playing out once more, but through this examination of with EQ.
Yes, it's a change of emphasis. Essentially, it's looking at it from a different point of view. The creation is the creation. We can't ever really know anything about the creation. So we have to approach it in symbols, in metaphysical ideas, in poetic statements, like in the beginning was the word. Or in the Book of the Law, as it says, I am divided for love's sake, for the chance of union. This is the creation of the world. The pain of division is nothing, and the joy of dissolution all. And that quote is preceded by none breathed the light, faint and fairy of the stars, and two. There's you zero and two. Yes, but it all comes from nothing. Well, that's the EQ version.
Could you then describe something of the Scarlet Woman and her importance in this cosmogony, this system that develops out from the analysis of numbers?
Yes. If you add up Scarlet Woman, and it comes to 128, 128, which is the same value as Baphomet. If you look at Baphomet, that character has all the elements balanced in his own being, and the Scarlet Woman has all the elements balanced in her being, in her, the elements of her personality are balanced. We find that Scarlet has the same value as balanced. And of course, 28 has the value of word. So the Scarlet Woman has a word, a magical word, which previously was considered to be the prerogative of the men folk in the temple were the only ones who were supposed to be capable of speaking a word.
But now it's been transformed through into this new aeon to be a word of the woman.
But the goddess is awake and stomping about all over the place making changes. She's been awake for about 100 years, 200 years now, maybe. Women's liberation is just the tip of the iceberg.
In your work, all this in a book is a really it's a really focused semi-autobiographical account of the discovery and development of the EQ. There are some really amazing windows into this period of British history, and especially there's one story from 1984 about the 16 naked witches in the woods.
Oh, the 84 thing. Oh, it was a Sun Venus ritual, and we'd begun to do Sun Venus rituals because of the numeric values around Sun and Venus. And Jake had a group down in Somerset, and we had our group up in Staffordshire. And we were in communication, and Jake and his group were doing some Venuses as well. So we had two different sets of experimental rituals to gather information out of and see, see what happens, see if it works even. So we went down to Jake's in 1981 or nine, yeah, 1981, and we did the Sun Venus down at Jake's. And then we thought, well, we'll invite Jake's crew up to Tamworth and we'll do a Sun Venus here. And we'll do it in the woods, as we have a little magical circle in some woodlands, about 3 or 4 miles away from where we live. And all the Sun Venus is happening at midsummer. Well, let's make a midsummer thing of it, a midsummer celebration. Well, let's camp. Well, let's take tents. And let's take food and let's make it, oh, I don't know, 3 days, a 3-day ritual gathering. And it'll be great. And we'll buy champagne and people will bring weed as well. So this was arranged, and Jake's lot hired a minibus and drove up. We got all the food and the sleeping bags and the tents, and we carried all this stuff into the wood. And there's a little village at the bottom of the wood, which we have to go through. And we get noticed as we're plodding along, carrying all this stuff and all our ritual equipment as well, our chalices and our magical swords and our robes and all this huge amount of stuff. Anyway, we get it all up there, and we build a fire in the circle, and we start our ritual. And we do an invocation, an initial invocation to Sun and Venus. And then we take our robes off with the idea that we've stripped ourselves of our identities. And at the end of the ritual, the high priestess will give us our robes back and we'll assume new identities. And we cook steak in the fire or veggie burgers for the vegetarian people. And we brought paper cups because you don't want to bring glass when you're camping. So and we have champagne and some spliffs going around as well. And we're having a fine time. And it's dark under the stars. And we decide to do a procession through the woods, which in the style of witchcraft ritual, the invocation quoted in Paul Hewson's Mastering Witchcraft. So this invocation in this it's designed for a leader and a coven. So the leader says, I shall go as a wren in spring, with sorrow and sighing on silent wing, and I shall go in Our Lady's name, aye, till I come home again. And then the coven say, we shall follow as falcons grey, and hunt thee cruelly as our prey, but we shall go in our master's name, aye, to fetch thee home again. And there's several verses, and the leader takes on different animal forms, and the coven hunts it or chases it down. And it's just absolutely splendid to do that, to do this, running through the woods with no clothes on at night. So we're doing this, and then there's a torch, an electric torch, back by the bonfire. And the police are there. There's a farmer who thinks we might be interfering with his livestock, which he's got on the far side of the wood. And so we have to, everything kind of crashes, and we have to go back to the circle and explain to the police what we're doing. And we have to get dressed and taken back to the police station. We're not arrested at this point, but we are kind of returned to civilization quite gently. It's in the middle of the miners' strike, which was a huge social event in the 80s. The miners went on strike for months and months. By the middle of summer, everybody was a bit fed up with it. So for the police, this was something really different. And when we got to the bottom of the wood and got to the where the police van was, they had to bring a one of those vans to get all 16 of us in. There's a whole line of police cars parked up the hill, 20 altogether, we found out later. They'd all come to see, to have a look, to see what this is all about, because we'd never seen anything like this before. So we go down to the local police station, and then the police who'd been left with our equipment and everything in the wood find a bit of cannabis. And so we are formally charged and arrested and fingerprinted and bunged in the cell, pending the arrival of the drug squad with a sniffer dog to see if they can find any more drugs. And they go up to our spot in the woods. And the sniffer dog sniffs out our food and heads straight for the roast chicken, which we brought with us for the 7 days eating. And won't sniff out any more drugs anywhere. He is not interested. His nose is full of roast chicken. So the drug squad come back a bit shamefaced. We get charged with possession of this. It's only an eighth of an ounce of cannabis resin, which is really not very much. We had managed to hide or destroy the rest of what we had. One of Jake's people ate a quarter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, he was the minibus driver. And he had to go back up to the woods with the police to pick up all the stuff, all the equipment and everything. And apparently he was driving along at about 20 miles an hour, about six inches away from the curb, the whole way and all the way back. So anyway, we decide that we won't blame anybody. We won't have a scapegoat. We'll all take responsibility. So all 16 of us are charged with possession. And of course it hits the local paper. As they report on anything, any arrests, and things like this that happen in the area. And they pass the story on to the Fleet Street crew, the national papers. And so they get hold of the story. So we find ourselves on the front page of the Sun. Curses, 16 naked witches caught on the pot. So that was one of the best headlines, and somebody else did Silver Star Streakers.
Your intention to have your identities changed was successful.
Oh yeah, very beyond our wildest dreams. The British press are allowed to report on arrests, but they can't say anything until the thing comes to court and a sentence is handed down because it might affect the decision of the court. So when we do get to go to court in the September, it was happened in June, but in early September we have to appear in court. We all get summonses. All Jake's people had to come back up from Somerset, and the town was flooded with Fleet Street reporters, all looking for some kind of a story. So we're in the court, and we receive our sentence, which is fines. We all get fined for this piece of resin, and then we come out, and we run back to Jim's place. Most of us managed to avoid the press, but the reporters come round to Jim's to do a formal, proper interview. And some of us are there. I was there. Jake was there. Loads of Fleet Street reporters all ready with their pens and their recorders. And Jim says to them, "What kind of a story do you want? Because we can do sacrificing babies if you want that kind of a story, but it won't be true. We can do you any kind of a story, but none of them will be true. Or we can tell you what we're really doing." And so he told them about astrology and about English Kabbalah and some conjunct Venus. And then at the end of it, he said, "Well, you won't print any of this, And the moon was in Scorpio at the time. And one of the main effects of the moon in Scorpio is that the thing that you expect to happen won't happen. So all these reporters thought they'd got a great story to break the monotony of the miners' strike reports. And the editors put everybody on the spike. They wouldn't print any of it. Highly amusing.
It's so much more salacious, maybe, to post about, Satanism and those things, which were very popular at the time.
Yes, the Orkney child abuse scandal was still quite fresh.
But when you actually sit down and explain it, then everyone probably their eyes probably glaze over and oh, we don't really know, we don't understand what he's talking about, so.
One of them did actually close his notebook and just listen. So,
That was an incredible story. Thank you for that, Kath. You mentioned that the what you were performing was what you called the Sun Venus ritual. We some of our audience may be familiar or may have heard of something called the 107. So could you explain exactly what is this ritual and why would somebody choose to do it?
107 is the value of Sun plus Venus. It's also the value of magician and silence has the value of 107. And the other three virtues of the Sphinx, to know, to dare, to will, to keep silent. Know plus dare plus will add to 107. So all these correspondences made us think, what happens if you celebrate a Sun Venus? And also there's the fact that the Sun and Venus, the conjunctions form a pentagram every 8 years around the zodiac. And that's a very significant shape, pentagram. And so all the indications were that this ritual would be really something worth doing. Let's try it and find out, see what it does. And another gematria to note is that Sun and Venus add to 128, which is the value of the Baphomet and Scarlet Woman, which kind of hints at what you might expect to achieve or attain if you perform this ritual, if you mark the time of the Sun Venus. So we dived in and we did these rituals and all many fingers were burned. But the upshot of it all seems to be that if you mark the sun moment of the Sun Venus, you put yourself at one of the points of the pentagram, and then the rest of the pentagram is drawn within you by the celestial forces. Or you become part of the pentagram that Sun and Venus are drawing themselves. And it's this kind of alchemical process of breaking down and refining and putting that together again. If you do a Sun Venus rituals, especially if you do complete the pentagram, if you do one for each point as it goes along. That was what we noticed happening. Afterwards, we didn't know when we tried it. We thought something might happen. And magician, Baphomet, Scarlet Woman, it's got to be good for something. But we didn't really anticipate what it would be like. But Sun is the The sun is the primary male symbol in the solar system, and Venus is the primary female or god and goddess. So it's like the alchemical wedding, the rose, Venus, and the cross, sun. It's not difficult to see where these symbols fit together and see where it's kind of going. That's what it does. It puts you into this alchemical wedding, and it refines you. It shifts out the dross and rearranges what remains. And at the end of it all, you find that the elements of your personality are balanced, as you've sorted out all the ideas about what you are and what you're not.
So this ritual, it's you mark the time of when the sun and Venus are physically in conjunction in the sky, but the actual process itself is something that takes place over a number of months
All years.
or
Yes.
years. Yeah. So this isn't something that you would say, like, walk into the circle and you would do a few hours worth of ritual work and then walk out and you're finished. This is something that lasts for an extended period of time.
Yes. Yes, indeed, it does. And the pattern of events and sort of stresses on the psychology and personality of the individual followed a pattern, a noticeable, identifiable pattern. At first, you think you've got it all down and you know what you're doing and all your bits are in order, and then something happens, and it's like walking into a lamppost. Something will break, something will stop, something will turn upside down. And then you're forced to do some reassessments. You carry on, but you don't really know what you're doing. You just hope that you're going to get somewhere. And then finally you get there.
I can attest to this specific, the potency of this process and how it breaks you down in ways that you can't possibly expect. Once you put yourself back together again, you find that you're somewhere else where you could never have imagined before you began. For me, it's something that I think everyone should consider undergoing and experiencing in their life for the genuine raw experience of it. And hold on tight, because once this roller coaster starts, you're on, you can't get off. But with certainty and that by the end of the process you will have been transformed in some really deeply spiritual, powerful way.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the essence of initiation. Initiation, being initiated, just means you've taken the first step. To initiate is to begin. It is an initiatory experience. It does transform you.
And this is why you call it the Ordeal X.
Yes. Ordeal X also adds to the Ordeal X, I should say. That's to 128.
And so in your book, House 418, you sort of explore more of a lunar side of this process. Could you explain something for our viewers about what you explore specifically in that text?
418 is describes the whole process that I've just kind of gone over. It's a four-stage process, symbolized in the zodiac by Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, and Capricorn, where Libra is the judgment, where you judge that you can do this, you judge that you're capable, and you judge that you've got everything you need, and all these sorts of things. It's also the judgment hall of Osiris. And there's only one way out of the judgment hall of Osiris, and that's through Scorpio, through death. And so you go from Libra to Scorpio, and that's the breakdown phase where something breaks, something is irrevocably rearranged, let's say. And then in the Sagittarius phase, you're wondering about trying to put yourself back together, trying to figure out what's going on. Sagittarius is half beast and half man. It's the alchemical card, or one of the alchemical cards in the tarot. And Sagittarius has the same value as hereafter. So it describes a rather confused, difficult to interpret period immediately after death. And then you get to Capricorn. Capricorn is the lord of the zodiac. Capricorn is Baphomet in the zodiac. Capricorn is the winter solstice when all the solar gods get born. And you get reborn as well when you reach the Capricorn stage. And the values of these four signs, Libra, Scorpio, Sag, Capricorn, they all add up to 418, which Crowley spotted as a significant number, but never quite got to the full gist of it because, of course, he didn't have EQ. But he did pretty well with what he got. Yeah, he was like the postman delivering a letter. He could discern various things from the envelope and the stamp and the writing of the address on the envelope. But he never got to open the envelope. He never got to read the letter. But yes, and Scorpio, 93 years, Scorpio is the death period. And it's the most magically significant portion of the zodiac.
Well, it also connects deeply with the burning way.
Yes. Yes, in horary astrology, this portion of the zodiac from 15 degrees of Libra to 15 degrees of Scorpio is called the burning way. And it's one of the indications that your horary chart is not capable of being accurately interpreted. You've picked the wrong time to ask your question and draw your chart, and you have to throw it away. It's a very unfortunate thing to find the moon in the burning way.
So, in regular magical practice, if you were to say, utilize this period astrologically, you could be in for quite, like you mentioned before, you could be in for burning your fingers. But EQ sort of changes this around a little bit because it makes the burning way into something useful as opposed to something that's just avoid at all costs. And I think that's really interesting because EQ has this way of transforming astrological conditions like the conjunction of the Sun and Venus, which would normally have been avoided, and the burning way as well, which would normally have been avoided like the plague.
The whole everything has evolved. We're moving, the whole solar system is moving through space. We're not in the same place we were yesterday. It's all constantly changing and evolving. And so yeah, EQ brings you to a different kind of use of astrology, which is not quite horary astrology. And it's not quite natal astrology, and it's not electional astrology, but it works. It's this kind of magical astrology.
Yes, that's how I like to interpret it. Stellar magic. Yes. So you mentioned in your latest work, The Mystery of the Letters, that the EQ, or rather magic itself, should ultimately prepare the operator for death. And the notion that the Western practice right now is in dire need of a what Jake Stratton Kent would always call a practical eschatology. Is a really big subject at the moment. There's a lot of people talking about it, and I think, for instance, in the 1990s and the early 2000s, up until that point anyway, I think that's when we started to see a shift in the way people were practicing magic, and since then people have sort of they've sort of turned back to tradition. And I think you see a lot more like people being really interested in folk magic and Catholicism as a medium of magic as well, and going back to the ATRs, for instance. What is it about the Q then that can be used in this way that we can explore this idea of an eschatology or how to prepare oneself for death, essentially?
This is what 418 is all about, really. The moon goes through these four signs every month, and if you follow the moon through Libra, Scorpio, Sag, Capricorn, just meditate. Just notice that the moon is in Libra, and then notice that the moon is in Scorpio. Notice things becoming balanced, and then notice things becoming dead, and then notice the vague dreaminess of Sagittarius, and then notice the completion in Capricorn. And then following month, do it again. Meditate on these again. And then it eventually make rituals. We made rituals. This is the idea. The EQ exploration of the astrological conditions is all about how to ritualize those astrological conditions or cosmic conditions, and see what happens. And so if you just ritualize Scorpio, you almost certainly will burn your fingers. If you ritualize Libra judgment, you judge yourself. And then Scorpio, you think about your death. And then Sagittarius, you think about what comes next. And then Capricorn, you get to your long home, you get to heaven, you get to whatever it is you think there might be after death eventually. And if you do this in ritual through the moon's passage through the signs. So when the moon is in Libra, you do a confession. And when the moon is in Scorpio, you burn your confession. And the Sagittarius and the Capricorn tends to apply to the individual. So I won't say too much about that. But you go in Sagittarius, you've gone through the death phase, and you just shot your arrow, and you are the arrow in flight. You don't know where you're going to land. You don't know where you came from, but you are the arrow in flight. That's quite a nice symbol to investigate in itself. And then in Capricorn, it's all resolved into something new. So you do the lunar rituals. You do the meditations to just get used to the timing of the moon going through these four signs, and to get used to these ideas, which may not be entirely what you're used to thinking about. Most people don't really think about death at all. They're too happy and too busy living to think about dying. And then when the sun gets to Libra, you identify yourself with the sun, and you do a ritual identifying with the sun in Libra in the Hall of Judgment. And then when the sun gets to Scorpio, you do a ritual identifying yourself with the sun in Scorpio. And that, of course, is the season of all the festivals of death. And then you get to sun in Sagittarius, and in the Western Hemisphere anyway, that's coming up to full winter. Everything is either dead or it's dying, and it's all kind of gone to sleep. It's dreaming. And then you get to the winter solstice when the sun gets into Capricorn. And the days have been getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and the light has been receding and receding and receding all this time. In a primitive sense, you're wondering if the sun's ever going to come back, or is it just going to carry on? Days getting shorter and shorter and shorter until there's no daylight left. Yeah. But at the solstice, of course, it all turns and the days start to get longer. And so you identify with the sun going into Capricorn. You find yourself being reborn.
It's almost like the after the balance and the breaking apart and the burning up, and then you're spread out onto fallow earth, and the seed that remains takes root and grows again. I really enjoy this process. It's fantastic. Would you recommend people go through it multiple times, or is once enough?
Do it as many times as until you feel you've done it enough, and then have a year or two off and then do it again. When Jim and I realized what was going on with 418 and what the whole sequence meant and what it applied to, we decided that this ritual would be a good thing to invent, to create. And so we put an advert online for one day for anybody who wanted to take part in a magical experiment. And we got six or seven people, I think, who communicated with us by email and told us what results they'd had month by month. We shaped the rituals according to what people had said about the lunar rituals and the meditations. We shaped solar rituals, and we all did it. Mind blowing isn't really enough of an expression to describe it.
I agree. Yes.
Is a difficult thing to do. A lot of people don't make it past the Scorpio stage. Sagittarius stage. It's so hard because you've got nothing left when you get to Sagittarius. It seems you've got nothing left to do anything with. You're utterly worn out and exhausted, but you have to keep going. It's like a journey. You set off and you think you've got all your bits and pieces and your little vehicle's working perfectly. And off you go, and then your engine blows up, and stuff happens, and you have to rewrite your plans. But you've still got to complete the journey. And so you're slogging along with half your plans in the bin and some kind of arrangement which you hope will work to carry you through to your destination. And you eventually get there, but it seems such a long way. And this sequence also reflects the crucifixion myth. Libra is the judgment by Pontius Pilate. Scorpio is the crucifixion. Sagittarius is the mystery of the 3 days in the tomb, where nobody knows quite what goes on. And Capricorn is the resurrection and ascension symbolism. And it fits all kinds of things. Once you get your mind round this sequence, this fourfold sequence, you see it all over the place, all kinds of things reflect it.
It fits into myth so well.
It does.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's a really important idea to discuss, and for I really want more people to know about it and learn about it. So I think it's amazing that we've had this opportunity to really discuss the process of the 107, the Sun Venus. But moving on to one of your next books, Finding New Symbols, which is an account of a really extraordinary magical exploration into the tarot. What role does the tarot play in the system of EQ? And I know that there was a specialized version of an EQ tarot that was in publication at one point, which I believe you designed.
Yes,
So.
and I published it. Hadean weren't able to publish it at the time, and I couldn't find another publisher, and I just got impatient. So I thought, okay, I'll do it myself. So I did a very tiny print run. There weren't very many editions because I couldn't afford to do many, and I didn't get any of the money back. Yeah, I didn't make a profit. I made a loss on that, but it was worth doing. But, yeah, Tyro. That book was supposed to be an exploration of spirits in the Book of the Law. I wanted to see if there were spirits in the Book of the Law that you could that a magician could contact. I've been talking to Jake, and it seemed to me that Jake had built a bridge from Geisha and sorcery into EQ with his Serpent Tongue book. And what I wanted to do was build a bridge from EQ back into Geisha. So I set about looking for spirits, and I thought the first thing I have to do is find the superior forces, the kings and dukes and princes or whatever. So I found 28 holy names or names of God or whatever in the Book of the Law to attribute to the 28 spheres on our tree of life, which we'll have to come back to. And so I was fiddling about with that and finding attributions and making tables of correspondences and really driving myself partly mad. And then I had this, I got a bit scared actually. I wondered if I could fit Crowley's system of trigrams, his 27 trigrams. I wondered if I could fit those on. And I fiddled about with this, and sure enough, I fitted those on. And then I got a bit scared because it was all getting a bit easy and a bit stupid. And so I stopped and I did a Sun Venus and asked for guidance. What am I supposed to carry on with this? And what is going on here? Or is it all just glamour? You have to watch out for things that are just glamour. It happens and you get deceived. And you can end up getting lost in your rabbit holes if you're not careful. So I kind of drew back and asked for guidance, and I got this, do a tarot. And what, me? Are you kidding? No, do a tarot. But I need help. These aren't my letters, these aren't my numbers. This is nothing to do with me. None of this belongs to me to fiddle about with. Oh. But anyway, yeah, I did this tarot, and then I had to rewrite the book that I was writing to account for this as well. So it was an interesting exercise for me, and I find that the tarot. My EQ tarot does work, slightly rearranged from the traditional one because there are more trumps. There are 26 trumps. If you have 26 letters, you have 12 for the zodiac and 10 for the planets and 4 for the elements. So it's a different point of view from the Hebrew tarot. And the Hebrew tree of life, which has the earth kind of, it's a bit of an afterthought at the bottom. Whereas the EQ tower has earth right there with the other elements, elevates it. And in this period, in this era, we've seen the earth as a globe in space. We have a different idea of the earth. We have an idea of the earth. Perhaps nobody has ever had before, or if people have had this view of the earth, it's not in recorded history. So it is a new time, it is a new aeon, it is a new period. And I think generally it is important for a magician to have some kind of divinatory skill. But I wouldn't go as far as to suggest that tarot is the way to do it. Plenty of people do divinatory things by other means.
So, as opposed to using the tarot as a form of divination, could you interpret the tarot as doorways into connecting with spirit? And is that more related to your exploration with the Book of the Law and EQ? What would you have to say about that?
every tarot card has a spirit, and you can contact spirits of the tarot just as you can contact the spirits of whatever it happens to be. So for instance, the Thoth tarot, those cards have particular spirits, and you're contacting them when you use the Thoth tarot to do a divination. The Rider-Waite tarot has spirits as well. They're not quite the same as the Crowley spirits, but they're similar, you know, because it's based on the same set of symbols. So the tarot that I did, the English Kabbalistic tarot, that has spirits as well. So I did find spirits in the Book of the Law.
Yeah, I was really fascinated by that book, and it really inspired me to look at magical texts like the Book of the Law in a different way. So thank you for that, Kath. That was really inspiring. Your next book, The Numbers and the Words, is quite literally a line-by-line breakdown of Liber Alba Legis, numerically. What was it that inspired you to create this landmark text?
Well, this is how I first encountered the Book of the Law. It was one of the photocopied versions that Jim's group produced when they discovered EQ. One of the things they did first was to calculate the values of all the words in the Book of the Law and add up all the phrases and sentences and verses, and then produce photocopies with the value of the words printed underneath the words. So you have a number underneath each word, and then at the end of every phrase you have that phrase's total value, and at the end of every verse you have total value of the verse. And this was how I first came to the Book of the Law. I found one of these and had a look at it, and it fascinated me. And it seemed to me beautiful, the numbers underneath the words, and the way it was arranged, and such a mystery, such a beautiful mystery. And this is what we used in the group when we were working EQ. We'd have our enumerated Book of the Laws, and we'd check numbers, and we'd add stuff up, and we'd make little notes in the margins. And shocking state these things were in after a year or two. I thought, well, this is really an essential tool for anybody who wants to get into English Kabbalah. It's not to say that English Kabbalah is fixed within the Book of the Law, because you can add up any English word. It extends to everything in English, not just the words in the Book of the Law. But the Book of the Law has its own significances, and some very important words exist in the Book of the Law. It seemed a necessary thing to put into publication for anybody who would find it useful.
And so how does this link with the idea of what I think is generally referred to in EQ as the war engine?
Lordy me, yes. The war engine. That's another 128, by the way.
How does one use such a thing? What could you describe what it is, and why it would be useful?
If you think of an expression that's in the Book of the Law, you might think, love is the law. What's the value of that? So you look it up, and you'd find the total value of that phrase, love is the law. And you'd also find the values of the individual words. Love is 44, is 28, and the is 59, law is 6. You know, add up combinations of those. What is the law? It's a work of reference, really. And there's a word list at the back, all the values from 1 to 231, and the words that add up, the single words that add up to those values. And there's an alphabetically arranged list as well. So all the words starting with A and their values, and then all the words starting with B and their value. Followed the ordinary alphabet because it's easier.
So I know why the number 231 is important with the Hebrew, because it's the number of permutations of the all the characters of the Hebrew alphabet. But why is 231 important in the English Kabbalah?
It's the value of circumference. It's the highest number in the Book of the Law. And circumference is the only word in the Book of the Law that has that value. And the circumference is the outside edge of the sphere in which you are the center. Circumference is infinite.
So yes, so I think people who are interested in working with the system of EQ, one of the first things that's really suggested that they do is to create a database or a war engine. It can be a notebook or it can be a note on a computer, but you use it to create what's the best way of describing it? Word webs connecting principles and concepts and ideas. And then you find interesting patterns by yourself, and it's the meditative process of going through that, which is part of the process of EQ, which I find well, I mean, it infects your dreams. You start to see bus numbers that have this, that have these deep meanings, or you get a bill with a specific number, or a beer costs so much money, and you're like, oh my God, why does my beer cost £4.18? And suddenly, all these connecting things and tunnels start to open up before you. And yeah, I think it's very, yeah, you mentioned before, it's very easy for people to fall down these rabbit holes and get obsessed, and lose themselves in these things. How would you, if you are working with a war engine and you are collecting all these numbers and you are, you do find that you're spiraling down a rabbit hole that you can't get out of. In your experience, over the years, how have you helped people, or how have you even helped yourself get out of that, or return to earth, sort of put your feet back on the ground? What's your best advice for that?
Common sense. Use your common sense, basically. If you suddenly find yourself thinking that you are a living God, just take a moment, see if you can walk on water, or see if you bleed, which you won't be able to do, and which you will, because you're not a living God, you're a human. But for that moment in time, that may be true, but only for that moment. You move on in time, you change. The notion of a living God doesn't change. In the moment, these things occur. You can have the most amazing spiritual experiences. You can find yourself on your knees in the kitchen with floods of tears emanating from your eyes as you feel yourself just filled with light and love and love and light and infinite love and light. It can really rewrite your programming for a little while. But you have to come back to reality. You will come back to reality. Your mind will mend itself. Give it time. And just use your common sense. It doesn't mean that you're specially chosen. It doesn't mean that you're special at all. It just means that for that moment, you were tuned in, and you were tuned in so perfectly that this occurred in these spiritual experiences. But you have to allow yourself to move on in the natural course of events. And if you don't, if you fix yourself in this idea, I am specially chosen, I am the scarlet woman, sooner or later something will come along and pop your bubble. The Roman emperors used to have a slave with them in the chariot as they rode along in their triumphant processions through Rome, where everybody was hailing them as gods or the next best thing to gods. The slave's job was to say, "Remember, thou art human."
In your most recent book, then, available through Hadean Press soon, The Mystery of the Letters, which I think is maybe your most inspired text of everything. I've read everything from beginning to end now, several times in some cases. But this is, in effect, it's sort of a summary of all of your discoveries and the development of this system of the English Kabbalah. The best way I can describe it is really as a series of meditations. You break down each major number and value, and you explore it very succinctly, but in such a with so much depth and richness that, I mean, the book itself is quite short, but it takes a long time to really process what you've read. Each section focuses on a very specific concept, which you not only flesh out, but you leave just enough room for everyone reading it to sort of bring their own experience and their own ideas to the table. I found it really enriching. So what was it that made you set out to accomplish this text?
I wanted to record, put into publication, put into the public domain, all the things that I hadn't included in any of the other books, the things that I hadn't written about. I wanted to give an overview of EQ. I wanted to save people the trouble of working stuff out that we'd already worked out 20, 30 years ago. Because everybody sooner or later is going to work out that mother has the same value as virgin. Well, what are you supposed to do with that? What does that suggest? What does that imply? What is the significance of that correspondence? Just what I wanted to make it a bit easier for people because there is so much of EQ. I've been at it now, I don't know, 40 years, and I'm still finding new things. I'm still adding up new words and being amazed by the correspondences. But the things in that book are basic to the English Kabbalistic system. They're basic parts of what we did and what fed into or what got worked into our rituals and our sort of working our theories into practice. Some of the, well, they are the ideas that we started out with. Just to put them there for people so they don't have to bother slogging all that way. It's very much like finding a new piece of land, all covered in jungle. Jim was hacking through the jungle and making a little path. And we were coming up behind him and making the path a bit wider and a bit smoother. And eventually, we made a path that's relatively easy to find. And Jake came along and built some structures in this. And now it's not as daunting as it was, because there's quite a lot of information to begin with. Whereas back when, we were finding it all new and we were having to test each bit to make sure that it was accurate and useful, not going to be a red herring of an idea,
Yeah, you laid out the discoveries and things that you've already found out, but not had the opportunity to write. I think in my experience, from what the way I was reading it is, I mean, I've read almost everything I can get my hands on regarding EQ. So even for me, after having read essentially everything that's in publication on the subject, I found some ideas that you were explaining here incredibly novel that I hadn't realized or I hadn't worked out previously, and or I hadn't put together from my previous experience. So even then, you say like these things that you put them out there to make sure that everybody understands. Like, I'm grateful for that. I'm really appreciative of that. So, thank you. Thank you for putting this this book together.
It's my great pleasure. EQ has been my life and my rock and my aspiration and all, my inspiration for 40 years or more. And it's what I people ask me, what are you? And I sometimes say I'm an English Kabbalist. This is what I do. This is how I live, according to my understanding of these things. It just seems to be a good thing to put into the world.
Yes. So
It,
thank you.
it's
Thank you
it's
so much for that.
it's helpful. It's helpful.
So finally, Kath, if people are interested in learning more about you and about EQ, is there anywhere online that they can find you? And is there anything that you're working on at the moment or you're particularly obsessed with that you'd like to share with everyone?
I have a small presence on Facebook. I don't do much on Facebook, but every now and again I post something and I leave comments on other people's posts. But now, while I've been waiting for this book to be published, I've been painting, oil paintings. So I have a little exhibition space on YouTube, which I call Magic Brush. So anybody who's interested in my artwork can go along and have a look at my little slideshows of my better paintings. And that's what I think I'll be doing for the foreseeable future is making pictures. Not planning any more books just at the moment. I thought I'd do four to begin with. And have them coloured according to the elements, but then I realised that it was going to have to go to seven, which would fill a spectrum. So it makes a nice rainbow on your bookshelf. And I've really said, written, published everything that's of any use. Or any help to anybody else who's interested in EQ. And yeah, this seventh book it's a very concentrated piece of work. I'm following Jim's idea really of just banging signposts in and saying, here's an idea you might follow up on. Here's a thought you might find interesting.
Yeah, and it's I think having read everything that you've put out, yes, you're very hands off, but you give just enough information that those who are interested have all the tools that they need to pick up what they need to and move forward and use this system. And it's such an innovative process, an innovative system in itself. So it's definitely going to be a unique process for every individual, which really puts this system up. So yeah, thank you for putting that book together the way you have. It's definitely something that you can sit and meditate on and really enjoy and
Thank you.
learn from in more ways than just the oh yeah, this word and this word have the same meaning. There's a more spiritual aspect to what those things have behind them, you know, what exists behind the numbers, behind the words. So yes, so thank you for that, Kath. I'd like to end by personally thanking you for the inspiration that you have given me and in my own exploration of the English Kabbalah, and for helping me to open my eyes to astrological magic in general. So your output in this field has helped to redefine magical practice for the modern era and has solidified your name as one of the true titans of the Western magical tradition. So thank you, Kath. It's been an absolute honor to talk to you today.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you very much indeed. I'm a titan now, am
That was Kath Thompson discussing her seventh book, The Mystery of the Letters, which will be available from Hadean Press soon. I was genuinely honoured to be able to interview Kath, as I have followed her since her first book, The Magical Language of the Book of the Law, and having personally undergone the ritual initiation of Sun Venus, applying her wisdom and knowledge, I can attest to its radical transformative power. Kath has been a hero of mine for a long time, and reading of her adventures and the thrill of uncovering something so moving and profound within one of the most unusual and mysterious modern holy books has been a great inspiration to me. So much so that I have devoted a sizable amount of my practice to the innovations Kath, Jake, and Jim Lees brought into the world. I am very happy to have had this opportunity to spotlight Kath's contributions to the development of astrological magic and gematria, which is still often considered controversial in thelemic and ceremonial circles. Getting the chance to interview Kath has been an absolute joy, and I am very excited to share our discussion with the world. Please hit the like button and share our videos with those who might find them interesting. I've had a really amazing year of meeting some of the coolest people in the occult community, and I'm so grateful to have this opportunity and this ability to continue having these interviews, and I'm looking forward to bringing more awesome people to your attention in the future. Thank you all so much for your support, and I will see you all again in the next one.